the Mideast, and the Midwest. A bit too similar these days. Today, Tuesday, August 19th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. With all the unrest in Missouri lately, many see a resemblance to the Middle East. This veteran reporter in Jerusalem just happens to be from St. Louis.
For me, the Midwest and the Mideast have always been far, far apart. But now the two are beginning to resemble each other.
Also, how an Army veteran wound up connecting online with an Islamist militant, and why.
It's always been a mistake historically to underestimate your enemy or to see them in the light that's less than humane.
And later, the special challenges of online dating across cultures.
You meet them, it's 50-50, like 50% chance that this person's like really funny and 50% chance that they're genuinely like an insane man.
All that ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Welcome to Ferguson. That's a phrase that's gone viral, and it's critical of the police action in Ferguson, Missouri. It's also perhaps too flippant a way to describe what's happening there, but that word Ferguson does capture the sense of chaos on the ground in that St. Louis suburb. Ansgar Grau is a reporter with Germany's Die Welt newspaper who's covering the unrest in Ferguson. He's reported from hotspots all over the globe, and he just wrote this: I've been in Iraq, Vietnam, and in China. I've met Cuban dissidents. But to be arrested and yelled at and be rudely treated by police, for that I had to travel to Ferguson. Earlier, I asked Mr. Grau to describe how he and another German journalist ended up detained.
We said, no threats. Everything is completely peaceful. We would like to stay here, to stay on and take some pictures. Then a young police officer answered, okay, but only if you keep moving all the time. The moment you stay standing, you stay put, you'll be arrested. And that's my last warning. And then I took pictures, but was walking around in small circles the whole time to assuage the officer. But he didn't agree with this try to circle around. He ordered that I and my colleague, we were cuffed in this handcuffed. And I asked the older officer to give me his name because he was in charge. And he only answered, my name is Donald Duck. And then we were transported to the jail in St. Louis. We were kept there for 3 hours. In the end, they took this mugshots. And then we were released. And the only thing on my mugshot, I could see the charges against me. It was refusal to disperse.
From your description, it does sound like an overreaction by the police, but it could have happened anywhere, really, in the world. Isn't that just kind of par for the course in a conflict situation?
Maybe it is, and maybe, but the other thing is, I was not the only journalist, and there were, I think, yesterday at least, I think, 8 journalists, and over the whole 8 or 9 last nights, there were more than a dozen journalists. And I think if it would be only one short overreaction, it's okay. It could happen everywhere in the world, but it happened over the last few days much too often in Ferguson, in Missouri, in the United States of America.
I'm just curious to hear from you, a foreigner, a German journalist who is well-traveled around the globe. What do you see as being kind of like the big stakes for the protesters in Ferguson? What's at stake for them?
I think some very small minority is there to make chaos and to make trouble. That's a very small minority. I think most of them are calling for justice in the case of Michael Brown. And to demonstrate that there will be justice, I think it would be enough if there would be charges filed against this white police officer who shot Michael Brown to death. And if he would be charged, if he would be brought to court, nevertheless, he could be, in the end, he could be judged as not guilty. But I think that would show for most of these black citizens of Ferguson that justice is at least on its way.
Could you imagine these racial tensions in Germany today?
I would like to say no, never. On the other side, although it didn't happen up to now, we have seen pictures like Ferguson in former times in France. We have seen them in the United Kingdom, and it could also happen one day in Germany.
Ansgar Grahl is a reporter with Die Welt newspaper out of Berlin. He spoke with us from Ferguson, Missouri. Our own Daniel Estrin, a St. Louis native and no stranger to tear gas, has been following events in Ferguson from his current home in Jerusalem. And he says there are a lot of unsettling parallels.
St. Louis is the quiet, friendly place where I grew up, just a 20-minute drive from the suburb of Ferguson. Jerusalem is the tense, volatile place where I report. But now the two are beginning to resemble each other, and the violence has hit close to home. The mother of 18-year-old Mike Brown, who was shot, graduated from my high school a year before I started my freshman year.
You need to exit the roadway. Get out of the roadway. Remove the objects from the roadway.
Yesterday, police fired tear gas and flash grenades toward the crowd of demonstrators in Ferguson. Police said they were responding to demonstrators throwing Molotov cocktails. It looked an awful lot like protests that erupted in East Jerusalem last month. I watched young masked Palestinians hurl stones at Israeli security forces, who responded with tear gas and stun grenades. That pop of the tear gas being fired sounds the same here and there. In fact, people in the West Bank and St. Louis have been tweeting photos of spent tear gas canisters, both manufactured by the same Pennsylvania company. Palestinian activists and St. Louis protesters have been bonding about all of this on Twitter. Here's 23-year-old Palestinian activist Lina Al-Safin, who's been tweeting about Ferguson.
I've never been to Missouri. I've never heard of Ferguson or St. Louis or any of that.
And here's 17-year-old high school senior Anthony Perkins, who's been attending the Ferguson protests. He says Palestinian protests never really crossed his mind.
I wasn't even paying attention to the news, to anything else before this. You don't really pay attention to things like that until it happens to you.
Perkins says he didn't realize Palestinians were tweeting about Ferguson until his cousin told him. When Perkins checked, he found Palestinians offering St. Louis protesters a whole lot of practical advice. Remember not to touch your face when tear gassed or put water on it. Instead, use milk or Coke, one Palestinian woman tweeted. There's a picture circulating on Twitter of a woman in Ferguson pouring a McDonald's milk drink over another woman's face and eyelids. Perkins tweeted, "From the bottom of my heart, I love every single person from Palestine that sent their regards."
It's crazy when someone across the world reaches their hand out to you to say it's going to be all right when they're going through something themselves. That made everyone feel good, and everyone was talking about it.
Some opposed to the police force in Ferguson have pointed out on Twitter that the former head of the St. Louis County Police got counterterrorism training in Israel. Others have tweeted that the two situations are not alike. Some have accused the Palestinians on Twitter of stealing Ferguson's limelight, but Lina Al-Safin disagrees.
Sometimes we get accused of being too focused on our own cause, being too selfish, maybe thinking that our own cause is the only one that matters in the world. But the fact of the matter is that oppression happens everywhere.
Anthony Perkins, the high school senior who tweeted out his love to Palestinians, says he's been going to the protests not only to demand an end to racial profiling, but to take pictures.
It is very scary, but I feel like someone has to do it. Someone has to be in the middle of everything so everyone else can be aware.
He says he's interested in a career as a photographer. And he says what's been happening in Ferguson makes him interested in traveling the world to document other conflicts. Maybe one day he'll be another St. Louis journalist in the Middle East. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
So there's this terrorist wannabe named Abdullah, and he likes Mrs. Doubtfire. This is not a joke. This is just the sometimes very odd reality of the world we live in. You see, when Robin Williams died last week, a blogger named Alex Horton got into an online conversation with that young man. And Alex Horton, once you started chatting with him online, did you find out who this person is?
Not much more than his profile suggested, you know, for very obvious reasons. This guy is an Islamic State supporter, so, you know, he's not too keen on letting the world know where he is and who he is. So after a few conversations with him online in the public, I had to reach out to him on direct message just to pry some more details out of him.
And what were you able to find out?
I was able to find out through some conversations. It was sort of like a give and take. You know, he knew that I was in the Army a number of years ago. You know, I deployed to Iraq in 2006. So there was a bit of a conversation about that. So I had to give up some of that, you know, what I thought about the war there, the escalating bombing campaign in Kurdistan. But I also found out that, you know, he was just a normal guy. He was from the West, just like me. You know, he boxed when he was a kid. And, you know, the funny thing that everyone seemed to like was, you know, he's a movie fan, just like I am. You know, he talked about Mrs. Doubtfire and Jumanji, and these are films that I watched over and over again on VHS tapes as a young kid and growing up in Texas. So we started to find some things that we had in common, much less than things we had in difference.
And do you know where he was actually when you were communicating with him? I mean, was he in Iraq, in northern Iraq? And once he was done kind of talking to you online, he was going to go pick up his gun and deal with some people out in the street?
Well, he's one of thousands of what I call critical nodes in the Islamic State system. You know, they're not fighters on the front lines. They're manning Twitter feeds and Facebook pages and other social networks to spread propaganda, you know, whether that be a decapitated soldier in Kurdistan or a public works project in Syria. You know, they're all about spreading the message. So Abdullah, he's not a fighter. You know, he wants to go. You know, personal matters, he told me, have prevented him from going to the front lines. But he wants to go there someday. But for now, he plays a very critical role in the way the world sees the Islamic State.
So, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, some people allied with Abdullah clearly disagree with him on Robin Williams. I saw a woman in California sent you a tweet saying, "You're tweeting with evil tonight, I see." So were there voices, other voices who had a problem with you even corresponding with an Islamic militant?
I really don't think they had a problem with me corresponding with the militant. I think it was more, you know, me personally as, you know, an Iraq veteran. You know, I think it was just this very strange view that, you know, if people who are aligned with the Islamic State or al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups, that they're simply monsters. And it's not the case. You know, they're very brutal. They've been killing civilians. They've been executing thousands of people. And it's, you know, unspeakable violence that should face worldwide condemnation. But we're taking the wrong view of people that, you know, have backgrounds and they love Robin Williams and they laugh every time they hear the Run by Fruiting scene in Mrs. Doubtfire. Like, these are the people that share the same backgrounds and same loves of art that we are. So it's always been a mistake historically to underestimate your enemy or to see them in the light that's less than humane. They are our enemy, and I've never strayed from that view, but we can't view them as some kind of this evil cartoonish force that's taking over Iraq. You know, they're supported by some Iraqis for a reason. They're supported by a lot of Syrians for a reason. And, you know, this is another step in evaluating why that is. And I think it'll help, you know, if we ever have to confront them on a larger scale, it will very much help to understand their motives beyond, you know, this evil taking over the world.
Yeah, I mean, one could look at your conversation with Abdullah as a random, odd kind of melding of minds about Robin Williams. But the way you're talking about it almost makes me want to ask you, could the conflict in Iraq kind of come to an end through an appreciation of Robin Williams, an appreciation of American pop culture? Am I kind of like fishing too far out there?
Yeah, you're fishing too far out there. I mean, this is – Robin Williams isn't going to bring an end to anything in Syria and Iraq. But understanding that people have motivations beyond terroristic violence is one way to start. Because, you know, the message we're sending when we talk about the Islamic State as unapproachable evil, you're giving them a power that they shouldn't have. So when we see them as people more than monsters, it takes away some of their mysticism. It takes away some of their power over us. They're taking territory and they're convincing people to join their cause because of the fear they produce. So if we take away that fear, that will be the beginning of the steps that we need to take care of this kind of extremist violence.
Alex Horton is an Army veteran and a national security blogger. Thank you for your time. Greatly enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. You'll recall the eulogies in this country when Maya Angelou died earlier this year. Such is the place held in the national consciousness by a major poet. Same with the passing today of poet Simin Bebahani. She was known as Iran's lioness, and today Iran is mourning the loss of one of its most beloved voices.
For the last seven decades, she has been the voice, the eloquent, the defiant, the honest voice of the Iranian people.
Farzaneh Milani is a professor at the University of Virginia who translated some of Behbahani's poems into English. They were also friends. And Milani remembers just how unique a voice Behbahani was in Iran.
She was a prodigy. She started writing poetry when she was only 14. And her concern has been social justice, human rights, democracy. And perhaps what is really endearing in her poetry is her rejection of any form of violence.
Behbahani's poetry was also noticed outside Iran. She was nominated twice for the Nobel Prize in Literature. She never won it, but made up for it with numerous other awards for her work. Inside Iran, though, her fearless writing drew government scrutiny. Her passport was confiscated, and she was banned from traveling outside the country in 2010. Even President Obama brought this up in a message to the Iranian people in 2011.
I'd like to close with a quote from poet Samin Behbahani, a woman who has been banned from traveling beyond Iran, even though her words have moved the world. Old I may be, but given the chance, I will learn. I will begin a second youth alongside my progeny. I will recite the hadith of love of country with such fervor as to make each word bear life.
UVA's Farzaneh Milani says Samin Behbahani was not intimidated by the government, even in recent years after she was prevented from traveling.
She never waited for the right place or the right moment to tell the truth. It's a loss for world literature. It's a loss for Iranian literature. It's a major loss.
Iranian poet Samin Behbahani died early this morning in a hospital in Tehran. She was 87 years old. If you've ever dated online, you know it can be hit or miss. But online dating between people of different nationalities, that's apparently even more challenging. Anya Yulenich writes about this in her new graphic novel, Lena Finkel's Magic Barrel. It follows the online dating adventures and mishaps of a Russian-American divorcee. Our friend and contributor, Alina Simone, has that story.
Like her protagonist, Anya Yulenich was also born in Russia and also discovered online dating after her marriage ended. I caught up with her at her apartment in Brooklyn to discuss the art of profile writing and how being foreign-born can unexpectedly complicate things, even when it comes to answering the simplest of questions.
Like if I say, I speak with an accent. When we meet, I will get these boring questions like, where are you from? How long have you lived in America? How do you like the USA?
But if she doesn't mention she's an immigrant,
then there is this shock when I like meet someone. Like they have to adjust to the way I talk. You can see them recalculating what they expected versus like what they see in front of them.
So if Anya doesn't want to be cast in the unsexy role of all immigrant all the time, she has to be strategic with her reveals, navigating sure giveaways like the ubiquitous list of music preferences.
My music preferences are just bizarre. They're just very, very strange. You know, I listen to things that my grandmas loved from like 1950s Soviet movies.
Когда весна придет, не знаю.
I have like a soft spot for really corny Soviet rock music from the 80s.
Goodbye, America.
I absolutely did not say the truth in that section. No way. It was all I just put down Radiohead and some things that I knew was okay to like in order to not be just outright rejected by men in New York.
It's depressing to think we must all circle the musical drain of Radiohead in order to find love. I mean, if everyone is out there lying about their adorable quirks, then how will we ever get to know one another?
I think you experiment in your profile with sort of the shades of truth. It's not really lying, because I do love Radiohead. It's just, it's omission. It's more like you omit the guilty pleasures, you omit things that make you seem too much of a foreigner.
However, being foreign-born not only colors how Anya is perceived, but how she judges potential suitors. Take the question, would you date someone who lives with their parents?
As an American, in my mind, what that implies is someone who's like a total loser. But there are all these other scenarios. You know, for example, if you're making a living here and then you bring in your parents from another country and you're supporting them.
Actually, Anya did go on a date with a guy who lives with his mom, but for a different reason. As a writer, she cares a lot more about creativity than whether someone is a hottie. And this guy claimed to be a whaler, as in harpoons and blubber.
He was just genuinely crazy. But I like crazy on paper. So, and with crazy on paper, it's like this. You sometimes you meet them, it's 50-50, like 50% chance that this person's like really funny and messing with the format, and 50% chance that they're genuinely like an insane man. So you take those chances.
Taking those chances turned actually finding a boyfriend into something of a whale hunt itself. But Anya still had her deal breakers. Anyone professing a love of fantasy novels was out. I mentioned that I'm in the middle of Clash of Kings, and even though Anya wouldn't date me, I'm not offended. Let's face it, when you're trying to squeeze the entirety of your human essence into one literary bullion cube, every word counts, even your username.
My username on OkCupid was Victory Day, which is very recognizable to Russians what that is, right? That's May 9th, the celebration of Germany having capitulated in World War II.
It wasn't meant as a come-on for flag-waving patriots from the motherland or anything. May 9th was the day Anya had her first kiss back in Russia. More of a personal victory day. American guys had their own interpretations, though, like it was some kind of pseudonym for Victoria.
I dated two guys who were still obsessed with their ex who was named Victoria, and somehow this username like opened up this, like, that's why they kind of got initially interested, or they would say it sounds like a porno name, or, but this guy was like, he wrote to me in the fall, in November, and he said, you know, if this were back in May, I would congratulate you with the Nazi capitulation, and I was like, well, that's cool.
It turned out her suitor was an art historian with an apartment full of books about socialist realism. Think idealized paintings of tractors and people picking wheat, which Anya ranked just a notch below fantasy novels. But by then, they'd taken their relationship offline, where there's no limit to the length of your answers or the depth of your questions. They met the week Anya handed in the final draft of her novel. It's been almost a year, and they're still together. For The World, this is Alina Simone from Brooklyn.
We have pictures and a few more cross-cultural observations from Anya Yulenich at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman. Think of the impact of some great American sportscasters, maybe Harry Carey or John Madden. For the Brits, it was this man.
Manchester City won, Everton won. Queen's Park Rangers won, Aston Villa won. Reading against Manchester United, late kickoff.
Remembering James Alexander Gordon, ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. It's a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I've had this question on my mind all summer, and I'm sure I'm not alone. Why would a parent send their kid alone on a dangerous journey? You know what I'm talking about. Tens of thousands of underage migrants, mostly from Central America, caught trying to cross the U.S. border. Even getting there is dangerous. Families hire smugglers, coyotes, to get the kids across. They risk their lives along the way. So again, why? We're going to try and answer that by hearing one family story. Jennifer Collins tells us about the journey of two children from El Salvador, as seen through their parents' eyes.
Jose and Esther have two boys. One's 11, the other almost 9.
Fuerte han sido mis bichitos.
Her boys are strong, Esther says. She calls them her little bugs. But she's very worried about them.
No es lo mismo decir, hijo, te quiero, lejos.
It's not the same to say, son, I love you from afar.
But that's what they've been doing for years. Jose and Esther live in the suburbs of Baltimore, and they're undocumented. Like so many other immigrants, they left their kids behind in El Salvador. But Jose says their country has become increasingly dangerous, especially the neighborhood where the boys live, near the northern town of Sosonate.
Sometimes they have to take off running for the house, because you can be hit in a gunfight there.
Stray bullets have hit neighbors. Gang members saunter into the boys' elementary school in the middle of the day. It's risky just sending them gifts. Jose says even certain kinds of Nikes are off limits. The gangs go after anyone who wears them.
You have to be especially careful when you buy shoes there. You can't buy just any shoes because you can lose your life for them.
The boys take refuge at home, but that's not entirely safe either. Esther and Jose left them with an aunt who they thought would protect them. But she and other relatives turned on them, beat them with belts, yelled insults at them, and then abandoned them. Finally, they were passed off to a 22-year-old cousin with two children of her own.
Somos culpables por verlos dejados solos y...
We are to blame to have left them alone and not thought that they would suffer so many things.
It's hard to understand why parents would leave their kids behind. But Jose tries to explain. He says when his youngest son, his namesake, was born, he took one look at the baby and wondered how in the world he was going to feed his family. Everything he earned in a day, he says, wouldn't even cover tomatoes, potatoes, the basic ingredients to cook a family meal. In El Salvador, minimum wage can be as low as $4 a day, and living costs are high.
If you want to buy a chicken, you'll pay $6.
So he looked at the $50 a week he made in El Salvador and the $500 he could earn in the U.S. and packed his backpack. Esther stayed in El Salvador to raise the boys, while Jose made his way to Baltimore, where he works cleaning apartment buildings.
I got it, buddy. No worries. I got it. Thank you so much.
He earns $9 an hour, 8 to 12 hours a day. Piling trash bags night after night, he saved enough money to first bring his wife north. That was nearly 2 years ago. Esther and Jose had been apart for 7 years at that point. They hoped to bring the boys along eventually, but when they found out their kids were in danger, they worked longer days and saved more money.
Por ellos estamos gastando cerca de...
Jose says they're spending $10,000 for both boys. He negotiated the route with the coyote. The boys will take cars and buses the whole way and stay in hotels. The fee pays for 3 attempts to get the boys across the U.S. border.
If you don't make it in 3 tries, you lose the money.
In early May, the boys left on their first try.
There are many dangers in the journey. It's incredibly dangerous to cross the border right now.
It's also difficult. Just an hour after crossing into Mexico, Jose says the boys were caught. For 3 weeks, they were detained in Mexico in a facility that houses mostly adult immigrants. There, they had to wash their own clothes and barely had enough to eat. Then, they were flown back to El Salvador. Their main lifeline to their parents is a poor internet connection. Jose is a Facebook dad. The 9-year-old, Jose Jr., says when the family bought a computer, that's the first time he saw his dad. They're the spitting image of each other. The boys barely leave the house because of the gangs. They play soccer, but inside. They could use the lawn, but it's full of trash. There's nothing to keep them here. And yet, the 11-year-old Kevin says thinking about a second journey north was tough. He says his brother didn't want to go. But Kevin says he's told his parents that he's decided to try again. In June, the boys set off for the second time. Barely a week into the journey, Jose and Esther received a phone call from another family traveling with their sons. Men in Mexican police uniforms were holding the group hostage in their hotel and demanding money.
91.
Desperately, Jose and Esther tried to reach the coyote.
You have reached a non-working number. Please check the number and dial again.
They tried calling back. They tried different numbers every time.
You have reached a non-working number.
It was painfully tense. Finally, Jose says they'll just have to wait and hope their strong little bugs will make it through. For The World, I'm Jennifer Collins.
Tomorrow, we find out what happens to Jose and Esther's boys. We've mapped out their journey, by the way. You can follow their trek and see some of their key stops along the way at PRI.org. Jennifer Collins' story was produced in association with Round Earth Media, mentoring the next generation of global journalists. Julia Botero, Eric Lemousse, and Manuel Oreste contributed to the reporting. The journey from Central America to try and cross the U.S. border illegally, it's dangerous, and so is going back home. That's the flip side of this immigration crisis, as thousands of women and children caught at the U.S. border are now awaiting deportation. Reporter Jude Joffe Block of station KJZZ in Phoenix, Arizona, traveled to El Salvador to find out what awaits those forced to return home.
We haven't seen a very big flow of that population back into El Salvador yet, though there's a lot of anticipation on the ground here that big numbers might be returning in coming weeks or months. And really, these countries aren't set up for that right now. And so the U.S. is actually giving money to the Northern Triangle countries of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador to improve their infrastructure so that they're able to be ready for when more women and children are arriving on planes.
So generally the process involves flying the deportees back, not sending them overland. Is that right?
That's right. There are deportees coming back from Mexico on buses, but those from the U.S. are coming by plane. The government here has been sort of adjusting its protocols, you know, doing interviews with children, trying to find out a little bit more about their situation. But basically, they're given pupusas, a couple bucks, and sent on their way from what we understand.
Pupusa is it's kind of almost like a little burrito, is that right?
It's like a tortilla filled with either cheese and beans or meat.
So no clear evidence yet that these women and children and unaccompanied minors are being sent back, but the anticipation that they will, what's that coming from? Is there news finally getting down to El Salvador about the detentions along the border?
Well, I think news is reaching here, but I mean, this is at the government level as well. And, you know, the U.S. has allocated funding to these countries to expand their infrastructure. So that's a pretty big clue that the U.S. is sending to let these countries know you better get ready because you have to be prepared to receive some of these children.
I know a lot of the kids are leaving because of gangs and violence. If the Salvadoran government, for example, could get crime and gangs under control, maybe fewer people would try to flee. So is the government in San Salvador doing anything to try and tackle that issue?
Well, the administration here is brand new. The Salvador Sanchez is a newly elected leader. He's left-leaning. He's a former guerrilla commander from the days of the Civil War. And his administration has been reluctant to say that violence is driving the children out. They say it's just one of several factors. But, you know, you can't be president in a country like this without acknowledging that there's a really serious security and gang violence problem. And so it's on everyone's minds. Just a few days before I arrived in the country, the president announced that he's planning to expand community policing throughout the country. So that's a clue he's given so far about the direction he plans to take the country in.
And I gather you just went to a town that kind of serves as a model for this community policing. It used to have one of El Salvador's worst homicide rates. What'd you see?
Yeah, so it's interesting. This area, Santa Tecla, it's an area that's now a destination to get a beer, go with your family on the weekend to buy some crafts and walk around, listen to some music. It's a business area that didn't exist before. And the then mayor, who's actually currently the vice president, he brought in a new kind of police that ride bikes and interact with folks and installed cameras everywhere and tried to kind of turn things around. And some people are saying that that's working. Others are a little more skeptical, saying that that's a nice model, but it's not going to really work to confront really deep-seated gang control.
Are people still leaving in as big numbers as they were some months ago?
You know, there has been a campaign here letting people know about the dangers of the journey and that a lot of those who go will be deported. So some of the rumors that might have been driving this earlier on seem to have been dispelled to a certain degree. How much that's translated to a change on the outflow, I'm still not sure yet, but I think it's a big question on everyone's mind.
Reporter Jude Joffe Block of station KJZZ speaking with us from El Salvador. I wake up in the morning, and like many of you, I want to hear this. Mostly sunny skies, zero chance of rain all week. But if you're in Iceland, this is the forecast. A very strong indication of magma movement east of Bardabunga Caldera. Yep, that is English, and it means the Bardabunga volcano could be about to blow, and stay away from the eastern side of it if you know what's good for you. Omar Valdemarsson is a reporter for Bloomberg News in Reykjavik. So the last volcano you guys had was a nightmare, not just for travelers, but for anyone who had to pronounce Eyjafjallajökull. I'm going to already blew it. This one is Bardabunga. Did I get that correct?
You got that correct. I think you need to work on your Eyjafjallajökull pronunciation.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years. So what is the latest with the Bardabunga volcano? We've been hearing news of a growing number of small earthquakes today, and they're growing in magnitude.
We're not growing in magnitude, but they're growing in numbers, and they seem to be moving further east.
And are earthquakes, these small earthquakes, a good indication of volcano activity?
At least they are a precursor of possible volcanic activity, according to the specialist I've spoken to today.
So just how serious is the threat then? Because reports kind of suggest it could be really huge, but we also know that these kind of rumblings are fairly ordinary in Iceland.
Well, if the volcano does erupt, then we obviously don't know whether or not it will erupt. How explosive it will be depends entirely on where exactly the magma reaches the surface. If it reaches the surface underneath the ice cap, it will result in a ferromagmatic eruption, which the water that's contributed by the melting ice will make it a more explosive eruption. But if it happens further north and passes the edges of the ice cap, the eruption will be less explosive.
Yeah, what kind of magnetic eruption did you call that?
Ferromagmatic.
Ferromagmatic, so as in magma. Now, I think what you're talking about, this has to do with the fact that this volcano, Bardabunga, is Iceland's largest one. It's also under a glacier, which happens to be Europe's largest glacier. So is that that kind of double dynamic you're talking about?
Yeah, there's a lot of glacier to be melted there. And if the glacier is melted, that could result in a big ash plume. And that's the thing that most people are concerned about.
So we're talking possibly Europe's biggest glacier melting. Does that have any concern for sea level rise?
No, it would never be the whole glacier. It would only be a tiny fraction of the glacier. So it wouldn't have any impact on sea levels, I would think. But according to a scientist I've spoken today, the ash plume of eruptions from this volcano can reach as much as 10 kilometers into the air.
Wow.
Which is about the height that airliners are traveling in.
Right, so that last volcano that blew a couple of years ago, both sides of the Atlantic, travelers were worried about the disruptions in their air travel, and that's what some of the warnings are about right now. But you've got over 300,000 people living on the island of Iceland. How do they feel? Are they worried?
There's no inhabited areas just around it, and the only risk that's posed to the general public is that they might be threatened by flash floods, but according to the scientists that are monitoring the situation, they are likely to get as much as 12 hours notice before any floods near populated areas. The only way that this could actually affect Icelanders directly is that, we could be landlocked for a few days when it comes to air traffic. And the other scenario is that more tourists will flock here.
Yeah, you see kind of volcano tourism on the rise?
Tourism has been growing in Iceland exponentially since the Eyjafjallajökull eruption. So I definitely do think that this helps get Iceland on the map.
Omar Valdemarsson of Bloomberg News in Reykjavik, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. More at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. When I went to Cuba many years ago, I met artists who were struggling to express themselves honestly while the government kept pushing its party line. Well, Algeria is sometimes described as the Cuba of the Middle East. It, too, has been closed off for years, and the government there also has a party line, one that makes it taboo to discuss Algeria's brutal civil war. The decade-long conflict began in 1991 when the military staged a coup that invalidated the results of free elections won by Islamist parties. Though the war is long over, Algeria has not moved on. But as Asia Bundawi reports, the younger generation of Algerian artists is trying to address the country's collective trauma.
Anytime I had a conversation with a cab driver in Algiers about the elections or unemployment, they'd always drop a reference to the Black Decade. That's the name given to the civil war that ended more than 10 years ago. Algerians remember the massacres and curfews, friends and family disappearing after going out for bread. And people here still live with the fear that any instability will spark another war. That's why shops still close at sunset in Algiers, and the capital becomes a ghost town at night, and why dozens of towns where massacres took place in the 1990s remain abandoned. The Black Decade is not a distant memory for most Algerians.
Even when they try to remember it, they remember it to forget it. Even the idea of change, you know, it's become a fear. You know, no, we don't want a Black Decade again.
Sofiane Zaghour is an artist in Algiers.
For me, I wanted just to dig deeper, you know, try to more know about it.
Sofiane is an artist on a mission to get Algerians to address the Black Decade and to help them move past it. For his latest project, he interviewed fighters on both sides of the war and recorded their stories on paper, in photos, on canvas, any way he could. One former soldier Sofiane interviewed recalled the sight of livestock wandering around abandoned villages. Their owners had fled and left them behind, and the images lingered in the soldier's memory.
He told me that when I saw this animal, I saw like phantoms of these people that they left their life there in this village and looking for other place, you know, with security.
And so Sofiane used the theme of cows in some of his paintings. He created evocative, haunting images of the lone animals circling abandoned villages. And he came face to face with the very people he and other Algerians had feared the most during the Black Decade.
During this period, you know, you feel afraid from everything, you know, even traveling, you know. This guy, he was the person that you feel afraid from. So he was in front of you telling you the stories. It wasn't like someone he's talking about, they did this or they do that. It's his story. I felt like I'm living again, you know, this period. So it was a bit difficult.
But even as the process has been at times re-traumatizing, Sofiane is intent on confronting the past and using his art to get Algerians to do the same. Marhoun Rugab is a young entrepreneur in Algiers and an art collector interested in Algerian art that depicts the Black Decade.
When you have a scar, the best way to get over it is to talk about it with someone, with the person who actually made that scar to close it, you know? I think the artists are exposing the scars. Unfortunately, not everybody is seeing it, only like a very small number of people.
That's because the only art galleries in Algeria are government-funded, and the government has treated the Black Decade as taboo. The Ministry of Culture hasn't launched a single exhibition addressing the subject, ever. This, compounded by the lack of private gallery space in Algeria, means that most Algerians will never get to see artwork like Sofiane's. Sofiane says people in Algeria ought to hear these stories. Many of the people he's interviewed, the former militants and soldiers, still call him. They want to talk and be listened to. And they want other Algerians to understand and perhaps move on.
For example, the military, he have very violent, you know, moment, and he keep it for himself. No one share it with him, you know. I wanted to share these stories. The idea is to show it here, to show it to the people that are concerned, you know, with this period. If you know these special personal stories, you will have an idea better, you know, about what's happened.
A German TV correspondent who covered the war in Algeria in the 90s once wrote something that still haunts me. It's like after a war, and yet it's completely different, he said, because you don't see any destroyed buildings. The facades of the buildings are intact. It is the souls of people that have suffered enormous damage. For the World, I'm Asu Bundawi in Algiers.
James Alexander Gordon. He died yesterday at the age of 78. He was the immortal voice of British footy results. That would be soccer results.
First, the classified football results as ever, read by James Alexander Gordon.
Barclays Premier League. Manchester City 3, Sunderland 0. Swansea City 2, Reading 2.
Every Saturday for 40 years, you could hear James Alexander Gordon, nicknamed JAG, over the British airwaves. He began reading the scores in 1973 on a whim.
I just read the news at 4 o'clock, and the presentation editor came in and said, James, nip over to the sports room and read the classified football results. Was I nervous? Not really nervous. I was excited at the prospect of being privileged to do this.
Now, the weird thing is, JAG was not a great football fan. In fact, other than a little bit of golf, he wasn't much of a sports fan at all. What he did know was music.
In the first game, it was Arsenal versus Manchester United. I'll always remember that. And I thought, I wonder if I could do that a bit differently to what everybody else had done. So I looked at Arsenal and I thought, they've lost. I'm very sorry for them. Manchester United have won. I'm delighted for them. And being musical, I thought, I'll get a, try and get a rhythm with this. Totally illogical, really. And I said, Arsenal, no. Manchester United, two. And that was just as simple as that, really.
And from that point forward, reading the football scores became something of his own weekly symphony.
Millwall 2, Bolton Wanderers 1. Peterborough United 0, Nottingham Forest 1.
He knew when to go up with the voice, down with the voice, and he just seemed to pitch it just right. He did it all with perfect enunciation.
That's Jimmy Armfield, the former England captain and now a BBC pundit. JAG was indeed famous for his perfect enunciation, not even messing up when the tongue-twisting team's East Fife played Forfar Athletic.
Of course, one day I'd love to read out on the air, Forfar Athletic 5, East Fife 4. I'd love to do that.
Catch that, Forfar Athletic 5, East Fife 4. Sadly, Gordon never got to read out that score. He finally retired last year after being diagnosed with cancer and had to get surgery to remove his larynx. But for many Brits, both football and non-football fans alike, his voice will go down in history. Or in the words of football poet Crispin Thomas, sometimes victory can mean so much. Sometimes victory is right within your clutch. Only one person you can really, really trust, James Alexander Gordon.
Barclays Premier League. Arsenal 0, Swansea City 2, Fulham 0, Tottenham Hotspur 3, Liverpool 1, Southampton 0.
And that's all from us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
Reading against Manchester United, late kickoff.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. RitaAllen.org, the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the value that contribute to a healthy planet. The Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs. The Annenberg Foundation, advancing a better tomorrow through visionary leadership today. More at annenbergfoundation.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.